The Green Front with Betsy Rosenberg, Wednesdays at 2 p.m. on the Progressive Radio Network.
Hello and welcome to a very exciting edition of the Green Front, exciting because of what is going on out there in our environment in Japan. It certainly has impact for all of us. The tragedy of the earthquake and tsunami and potentially nuclear meltdown has all of us riveted to CNN, to radio reports, to everything coming out in the newspaper, on the internet. And, of course, this show is no exception since we do cover our energy needs, our sources, various options for future energy supplies. So this is very relevant to the Green Front. Thank you for joining us. I guarantee you, you don't want to miss this first interview especially. As we have this perfect storm scenario for environmental disaster that is still, of course, unfolding in Japan with repercussions for us in the U.S., we're going to be talking with the author of a book that advocates for nuclear power as a viable and safe energy source. My first guest is Gwyneth Cravens. She is the author of Power to Save the World, The Truth About Nuclear Energy. With these scary truths still unfolding and this perfect storm of events, very eager to hear what Ms. Cravens has to say about developments so far and what they might portend for the future of nuclear energy in this country. In our second segment, we'll meet another female author with a decidedly different focus. Osprey Oriel Lake has written a book about the power of nature to heal us and transform us. But first, we want to welcome Ms. Cravens to the Green Front. Welcome her for being available on short notice. I don't even have her book, haven't looked at it yet, but very intrigued to hear her thoughts. From my understanding, Ms. Craven, you changed your mind back in 2008, not so long ago, about nuclear power. You were against it. Now you think it is a viable option and want to find out how you feel, obviously, in the wake of this still escalating series of events. Welcome to the Green Front.
Well, it's, thank you for having me. I feel very strongly about the progressive agenda and about protecting the environment. And that actually is what led me to change my mind about nuclear power. The change began, I began having conversations with scientists in late 1999, and I couldn't believe some of the things they were saying about nuclear power and why it was cleaner than coal combustion and so on. And I started doing a lot of research. I talked to many different people in the nuclear world and in the energy world in general, and went on a nuclear tour of America. And I learned some surprising facts that I had not known, and those led me to change my position. I had petitioned to shut down the Shoreham nuclear plant in Long Island, and as a result of my fellow protesters' efforts, the carbon footprint of Long Island and the air pollution there is far greater than it would have been if Shoreham had opened. There were problems with the plant. That's a whole other story. But they would not have been putting toxic pollution, toxic to our airways and the toxic coal waste and so on that we have to deal with.
Certainly
changing the climate.
Certainly big challenges. So you're saying that it was in part your concern for escalating climate change and CO2 emissions that made you rethink nuclear, as did Stuart Brand before you.
Absolutely. I could have sort of said, well, you know, maybe nuclear power is a bad idea, and we have to look at other things, but we have time because everything's... there was no... when I first began, the sort of terrible... weight of the global climate change had not come to me. You know, I knew some traces of things about it. I hadn't paid much attention. I thought it might be happening in Africa or somewhere, you know,
or Alaska.
Or, yes. Well, I didn't know about Alaska. I didn't know the temperature was going up 6 degrees.
I began to in 2000. That was it. You know, the experts were the main people who knew it then. So I sort of knew about it, but it seemed like one of those background drum rolls, not a front one. But the more I learned, and the more I learned about ocean acidification, which is, according to some scientists, a far worse scenario that's going on as the ocean takes up carbon dioxide, the excessive amount, that acidifies the water, and it can cause a wide extinction of species. It's already harming corals, preventing some, plankton, phytoplankton from forming their shells. And we depend on the ocean for about half of our oxygen. So this is real. This is very serious.
Not to mention food needs for the world.
Over a billion people rely on it for food. So these are the concerns. So then you look at what is realistic and how can we replace fossil fuel combustion? And the only large-scale, expandable way to do that without making a huge environmental footprint is nuclear power at this point.
And at this point, on Wednesday, March 16th, as the disaster in Japan continues to unfold, what are you thinking now? Obviously, we have an environmental catastrophe, a series of environmental catastrophes. This is a perfect storm. This is worst-case scenario with
yes.
a 9.0 monster earthquake triggering a killer tsunami and
yeah.
then a series of cascading events that are impacting some 6 reactors.
Yes.
If this isn't a worst-case scenario, I don't know what is, and we don't know the full impact yet. We have to keep saying that, obviously, for anyone who's listening after the fact. We'll know more. But how are you feeling about now? I'm sure you're in demand for anyone who knows about your recent book.
I have been doing interviews and stuff. I'm terribly sorry for the people of Japan and incredibly impressed by their stoicism and bravery. The people who are working hard at the nuclear plants to control the events there are heroes. They have lost family and homes, and they're showing up for work. And at some risk. At present, there is no risk to the public from the radiation and so on. It's low level.
But do you think that's likely to continue to be the case as
yes.
this goes
yes.
into the next series
yes.
of events?
Yes.
How can you be confident given things? Every time I turn on CNN, it just seems like the news is worse.
They are having trouble.
In terms of them not being able to get control of the situation.
I agree. And it's partly that these are old plants that lack, for example, what they call gravity feed, passive safety features, which don't rely on electricity, big tanks of water that you can release without having electricity to pump it, and releases into the containment building or into the reactor or into the spent fuel pool and keeps all you need is water to keep this stuff under control. And
they're dumping seawater in, it's not under control yet. So.
They're still having trouble. It's a complicated picture, and it's not very clear. I think they're working so hard to solve the problem that they don't have time to chat extensively with reporters. So we're getting little pieces of information, so we don't have the whole thing. But the Japanese have done everything very well. As the New York Times pointed out today, there will not be anything like a Chernobyl, that is exposure of a large population to radiation from this, because they've evacuated people and they've passed out potassium iodide to prevent the uptake in the thyroid of radioiodine. Also,
I don't think the Japanese
eat fish, so they have a good supply of iodine in their thyroids, so are not as likely to take it up as the people who lived around Chernobyl.
So you're not at all concerned? So you, how concerned are you, would you say, about the people in the immediate surrounding area? And then, you know, what about there's people who are concerned here on the west coast of the United States? I mean, we saw a tsunami, and within 12 hours, we had, you know, warnings of a, you know, small tsunami reaction.
Yes.
Right here in our back door, right on the San Francisco Bay here. So if water can travel that quickly, why shouldn't we be concerned about radioactive cloud and contamination hitting us? First and foremost, the Japanese people. I don't want to make it all about us, but we here in the U.S., you know, are paying very close attention, and
well,
any of us are alarmed.
This is partly, I have to say, speaking as someone who would have been very concerned about just what you're talking about, until I learned a lot of the facts about radiation and what it can and cannot do. And the people are afraid because they don't know that much about it. And unfortunately, it doesn't seem to be taught in the schools that much. So
we know it can kill. I mean, people lost their lives in Chernobyl, and this could reach the scale of Chernobyl.
Here, let's go back and let me just explain a little bit about radiation. There are three different kinds, alpha, beta, and gamma. And alpha and beta are stopped. Alpha is stopped by your skin or a piece of paper. It doesn't go very far. Beta can be stopped by, like, water or wood. And then you have gamma, which is more penetrating, and that can be stopped by dense materials. So the people, they've evacuated around the plant. And they've told people in the wider circle around the plant to stay in their indoors, in their houses, and if they have to go out to, you know, cover themselves and so on, because clothing will protect them from these particles and rays. But at present, the emissions are low level. At this point, the exposure to people living around the plant is low.
What if
it's
there
the
is
the same as if they had a dental X-ray or took a jet plane from Japan to the United States or something like that. So
but there's partial meltdown now. So what happens if there's full meltdown?
Well, to the public, not necessarily anything. The core melts down into the containment vessel, and it's this sort of puddle. And at every hour, this material is getting cooler as the decay heat goes out of the reactor core.
And
so,
if the containment vessel fails, isn't that part of what would define a meltdown?
It would have to be a huge failure for it to get outside of the boundaries of the plant. And
huge failures, I guess, feel possible right now, you know, from where, you know, we're sitting watching, feeling kind of helpless, and I'm sure the Japanese even more so, feeling very exposed.
Understand. But I'm just trying to say that it is not a good scenario. It's terrible, but it is not devastating. And I want to mention that even Chernobyl, where 50 tons approximately, they don't know exactly, but about 50 tons of nuclear fuel were vaporized and went up in smoke at Chernobyl as the graphite reactor burned. These are not graphite reactors in Japan. And so that was a horrendous accident. The death toll from that was a total of 60 people. About 51 of them were killed outright or died shortly after. They were workers in the plant. And then there were several cases, unfortunately, of people children who got thyroid cancer that went untreated. There were 9 deaths from that. So the death toll from Chernobyl, from radioactive stuff, is 60 people at this point. They estimate that about 4,000 people would get thyroid cancer because the Soviets didn't give them potassium iodide pills. In areas where they were given, in Poland, where they were given potassium iodide pills, there was no spike in thyroid cancers. So they estimate that, and thyroid cancer is highly treatable, fortunately. But it was a bad deal, and there are pockets of that are, you know, hot spots around in the Chernobyl area, in the villages. They're marked, people avoid them, and 30 years later, they've really, they've decayed away. A lot of that background material has decayed away, and the forest around Chernobyl, because no humans are living there, is flourishing, full of plants and animals and stuff. So
do you think
the actual toll is less coal kills 10,000 Americans a year from just the fine particulates that are formed from the gases coming out of the stacks of coal-fired plants and gas plants. That they combine, those nitrogen and sulfur gases combine with water vapor and make fine particulates that get in the airways, the lung airways, and kill people with lung cancer and heart disease. That's 10,000 a year. That's a lot of Chernobyls. So I want to put this horrible, terrible catastrophe and the suffering of the Japanese people in some kind of perspective. They have a lot of other terrific environmental problems they're facing, including an oil refinery that blew up, and that toxic waste, and a lot of toxic waste from the gas tanks on fire and so on, in the air pollution and so on from this is tremendous. So the radioactivity is not over the threshold of where it would cause damage. That it would have to be thousands of times greater.
Not yet, but again, it's still, as
well,
you know,
we have,
happening.
I don't have a crystal ball, and as I say, the information is coming out in pieces and sort of hard to know, but these people are very dedicated to getting this under control, and I'm sure that they are going to be able to do that. Meanwhile, they are protecting the population by having them evacuate, by having them take potassium iodide, and those in the outer ring staying indoors, keeping indoors and keeping their skin covered. If they get exposed, the best thing, and this is an important thing to know in case you're in a place where a dirty bomb goes off, which we can think about in this country because it might happen, a dirty bomb being a conventional explosives coupled with a radioactive source, let's say from a medical radiation device or something. If you're exposed in a situation like that, you take shelter immediately. You go indoors somewhere, and you will avoid radiation. And you, as soon as you can, you take a shower, and you change your clothes, or wash your clothes, or get rid of your clothes, and put on fresh clothes. So that's something people ought to, they ought to teach that as a sort of civil defense thing.
And are you recommending that people who are concerned take potassium iodide or at least stock it, people who are either, you know, in the range in Japan or some who are hypersensitive here on the West Coast feeling like, you know, we're not getting the full story, and before anything does get over here, they want to take precautions? I mean, there is a run on potassium iodide.
I understand that.
Is that overreaction or is that
cautious? On this coast, yes. I've talked to several scientists, and they say and when I was writing the book, I went into the whole potassium iodide thing. It is useful for protecting the thyroid from radioiodine. But radioiodine decays pretty quickly. So by the time those particles blew across, first of all, that's the most important thing to talk about, is the concentration of radioactive material. Do you take a vitamin that has selenium in it?
Yes.
So do I. But do you know, if you took, like, a tablespoon of selenium a day, you would be in very bad shape. But your body not only tolerates a small dose of selenium, it's good for you. Radiation is like that. If you have a big dose of it, you have problems. People who have medical radiation, and I'm sure you have listeners who have benefited from medical radiation, they get very large doses, and they recover from them, and they go on to live good lives.
Ironic. There was a story on the Today Show this morning about, you know, people being concerned about levels of radiation, you know, going through airport security, and all of a sudden that seemed pretty minor, although there's people who travel regularly, compared to, you know, what is at stake right now.
Well, or the worried well who go take, go have CAT scans just because, you know, you never know, you better have a CAT scan. And, you're getting a dose. And if you smoke, you're getting a huge dose of radioactive material in the tobacco that's burning.
We're also getting a huge dose of reality right here in this drama that's unfolding.
I understand. I'm just trying to put these winds. When this stuff is coming out, and, you know, and these hydrogen explosions they're having, there is some radioactive material in it, but it disperses and most of it has been blowing out to sea. The wind, there's a problem with the wind, so it may blow
every
inland.
Every time they say it's blowing, you know, from the east, they show the arrows and they say that's good news for Tokyo, and then some of us on the west coast are saying it's heading right for us. But
it's
not to, again, worry about that at this point. There's plenty to worry about long before then.
There's a lot of those will have decayed, these particles. The hotter the particle, the more dangerous, we might say, the particle, the quicker it decays. But the thing that makes it so radioactive is the thing that makes it sputter out quickly.
So the 5,000 or so miles it would have to travel, a radioactive cloud, from the coast of Japan to the coast of California, what are the chances that anything that could cause any human damage, health damage, would reach our coast, in your understanding?
I think minimal. I think if you decided to go up in the Sierras instead, let's say you said, oh my God, I live on the coast and I'm really scared. I'm going to go up.
Heading for the hills. A lot of people
are,
yeah.
For the hills. I'm going up on one of these big... I'm going to Mount Shasta. Hide out there. You would increase your radiation exposure.
Because
people around Chernobyl, the natural background radiation is low there. If those people, if people living around Chernobyl said, okay, we've been through this, we can't take any more of this, we're moving to Denver, they would be tripling their exposure, because naturally at a high altitude you have more cosmic rays, which are, you know, about 30,000 times a second. We have cosmic rays interacting with our molecules and atoms.
Okay, well, I have a lot of friends who, if they were listening, they'll probably listen after the fact, because they're at work. You'd be saying, you know, that's crazy. That sounds like, you know, these people who are, you know, saying that volcanoes cause more damage, you know, climate change than CO2 emissions from coal-fired power plants and our cars. But I know, because you're a friend of a friend of mine, this friend, mutual friend, being very green, that you are an environmentalist, someone concerned about our environment. So that's why I appreciate your being on the show. I could have easily, gotten, 50 anti-nuclear advocates on to say this is a sign, and believe me, there's a strong part of me that agrees that we should, put the brakes on any new permitting, stop and look and
These were old plants. The Japanese had been lax about certain preparations. The plants in the U.S. are not vulnerable the way this setup in Japan is.
Well, I want to get to that.
Yeah.
But let me first ask you, why are we building nuclear power plants on fault lines? Why are they? Why are we? I understand why it has to be
really
on a body of
question.
Water now that we understand. And by the way, we're getting a crash course education in, how nuclear reactors work. That's the silver lining, pardon, or green lining, pardon the expression.
Yeah.
But we understand why they have to be near water for the cooling source. But why on faults? Did we not Was anyone considering a 9.0 earthquake in any scenarios, be it Japan or the U.S. or any place else, France, Germany, where they have nuclear power plants?
In the 1960s, I don't know the extent to which that was taken into consideration. They did, at this point, you cannot site a new reactor on a fault. You have to, if you have a piece of land where you want to build a nuclear plant, it has to be, the reactor has to be anchored in stable bedrock. And if there are faults around, you don't get permitted. You don't get
It's not like earthquakes are a recent phenomenon, just the last, 40, 50 years.
Well, learning curve. I mean, when you fly over Chicago, there are coal-fired plants basically in the middle of the city puffing out deadly smoke. And that's because they just wanted the coal-fired plants near the city. So today that would not be allowed. If you think about, we didn't used to have seatbelts. We didn't used to have airbags. We've learned.
We may learn that nuclear power is not, in fact, a safe option. Is that a possibility? Is that anywhere in your scenario?
Well, we have to put it, again, in perspective. Even with Chernobyl, the death toll per terawatt year of electricity generated is lower for nuclear than for any other large-scale power source. And in fact, it's lower than from wind power, because if you look at per kilowatt hour, people have been killed by wind turbine blades.
Well, I know, but come on, that's what you're going to hear.
I'm not saying that we shouldn't have wind because people were killed by blades. But if you just look at the accident rate, the Columbia School of Public Health did a study of the accident rate in the nuclear industry, and they found that it was lower, and the death rate actually lower for people working in the nuclear industry than from various other industries. And the Bureau of Labor Statistics found that it was safer to work in the nuclear industry than in the banking or real estate industries in terms of accident rate.
Wait, we just have a couple of minutes, and I have to ask you a couple of key questions. I'll kick myself, and a lot of my friends will be yelling at me. First of all, what about radioactive contamination getting into the ground and the water supply, impacting, you know, crops and fish? You say it's relatively safe for humans, and we can take a shower or stay inside, shelter down, shelter in place. What about the longer term, you know, getting into the food chain, getting into the ecosystem?
Getting into the food chain. Well, we have to see. But at this point, it doesn't seem to be. There hasn't been a massive release of concentrated radioactive material. So,
yes.
I doubt if it will be much different. As far as fish go, ocean water is more radioactive. If you go into the ocean, you're entering a more radioactive environment than land because all those radioactive elements like uranium and thorium and radium wash into the sea. So the sea is actually more, is, quote, hotter in terms of radioactivity. So it probably would not change the radioactive level of the Sea of Japan or the Pacific Ocean. And the soil, with the soil, the thing about these particles is they decay. So if somehow there was a big release and particles got into the soil, like in Chernobyl, they've decayed. However, the toxic heavy metals in coal fly ash, and by the way, the United States produces 120 million tons a year of coal fly ash. That's a coal train 9,000 miles long. That burning coal concentrates toxic heavy metals. This is just stored in online slurry ponds. It's just lying around. We put 179,000 tons of batteries a year into landfills. They contain toxic heavy metals. So you have to put it in perspective. So to get back to the people of Japan and their food source, all of those toxins from the natural gas combustion that's still going on, you know, in villages and stuff, as you know, in the rubble, and the gas plants that blew up, and the oil refinery that blew up, these are dispersing a lot of toxins, which will get into the water and into the soil. Much, much worse, in my opinion, than a very small amount of, and it's kind of hypothetical how much radiation is actually going to get into the environment. At this point, it doesn't look very concentrated or very, very much above natural levels.
At this point, but again,
at
the disaster
point,
is still unfolding.
It could get far worse.
They can't do interviews. They don't have time. And, you know, the workers are supposedly crawling around in the dark, you know, the brave 50, you know, men and women who are in there.
Yeah.
And so we don't know the full story. And there's a lot of people who, you know, are questioning the government account. The government probably, they don't know either. This is uncharted territory. And, of course, that is what's so frightening about it. I appreciate your being a voice of calm and reassuring us. And I hope you're right. I trust you have looked into this. You've written a book about it. So
that's why
I wanted to have you on, is so we don't just go into panic and don't go into the, understandable response, which is, you know, put a brake on all nuclear power plants, which maybe we should, by the way. But in the midst of this disaster, I wanted to get someone who is a proponent, after looking into it, you know, it's safety to say, okay, worst case scenario here unfolding, how do you feel now? And it sounds like you don't feel much different than you would have felt a week ago, other than acknowledging the tragedy and
it's going to be unfolding for
more than weeks, months and years to come for the Japanese people and maybe beyond. We don't know where it's going. Let me ask you this. We just have a couple minutes. How do you feel about, you know, other forms of renewable energy that are certainly safer? Are they scalable, in your opinion? I'm talking about solar power, wind power, geothermal.
All good. They're all good. keep in mind that to make a kilowatt hour of electricity from a wind farm, you need four times as much steel and concrete as to make it from a nuclear plant. So that means burning coal to make the steel and the concrete, because the base of one wind tower is a concrete block about 45 feet by 40 feet. So what people don't realize until it comes to their backyard is that this is heavy industry. And I grew up in the high desert of New Mexico, and so when people say, oh, well, there's nothing happening in the Mojave, let's just blade this pristine desert and put in a huge wind or solar array, and let's put in a lot of high transmission lines, they're talking heavy industry. And I want to say something about natural gas, because some environmentalists are big proponents now of having natural gas as a fuel source. When you frack to extract natural gas, that so-called clean natural gas, radioactive material is brought up, and it winds up in the rivers and in the drinking water. It's low dose, let me say that. But if you're worried about radiation, first worry about the radiation from coal-fired plants, because you're getting 100 to 400 times more radiation from a coal-fired plant than from a nuclear plant.
Well, since there's a movie about fracking and we're learning the dark side of fracking as a practice, we saw with the BP oil kill this summer, and now, again, the trauma in Japan. If nothing else, this should get this country, and I'm talking media, politicians, and the public, you know, a lot more focused on our energy needs, because, you know, the experts I listen to say we've already reached peak oil, and the second half is going to be a lot more difficult and expensive and costly to go after. And if we are running out of oil, we are going to have to make a transition to what exactly? And if solar and wind are not, you know, going to get us there fast enough, and if we are seeing worst-case scenarios like this happen, and we haven't even talked about the possibility of terrorist attack on nuclear reactor sites.
Well, they are very heavily defended, so you can relax about that. A plane flying into a containment building with pancake, and if you go to my website, cravenspowertosavetheworld.com, and you go to the FAQ, you will see a film of a plane doing just that, going into a concrete wall that's comparable to a nuclear plant.
Thank you for giving your website. And just one last question before we have to say goodbye, but I would love to follow up with you when we do know the full story.
I would be happy
to
continue.
Days and weeks go by. What about the resource-intensive nature of nuclear power plants, the water it takes to run them, and the incredible cost to build them? Do you really think we should be going forward, full steam ahead, pardon the pun, on nuclear plants, safety issue aside, just for a moment?
Yeah, let's talk about the economics. Once a nuclear plant is built, and a lot of the cost is because it's so highly regulated, it is so strictly regulated in the United States, that just to get a license, even for a small reactor, I know someone who's working on a small nuclear reactor design. It's $100 million that goes to the Nuclear Regulatory Commission. So it's very expensive just getting licensed. And
the license costs aside, just in terms of the resources, environmental resources, natural resources it takes in terms of water.
Well, here's a good thing about a nuclear plant. It can desalinate water. And it can take the brackish water in the desert, and let's say there's a desert aquifer, but it's undrinkable water. You know, it's got a lot of minerals or arsenic or something in it. You can desalinate that with a nuclear plant very efficiently. So the water, I don't think, is an issue. The costs are not from the fuel, because uranium is cheap fuel. But what I wanted to say about once a nuclear plant is constructed, it rather quickly earns back the startup cost because of the cheapness of uranium fuel.
We haven't even talked about the waste, the rods that are sitting there as part of nuclear waste, and what we do about that since we don't have any particular...
The French recycle, and they have a family of four in France who gets all of their electricity from nuclear power. Their share of the waste for 20 years of electricity that's not putting out pollution in the air and so on, their share of the waste is a glass cylinder the size of a little Bic lighter, you know, a little cylinder.
But these nuclear rods that are used, the ones in Japan, are you worried about them being there, right there on site during this disaster?
Yes. I think one of the bad designs about the plant, and if I had I'm not a nuclear professional. I'm not an engineer or anything. I'm just a writer. But if I had visited that plant in Japan and seen where they kept the spent fuel up on the top floor, I would have said, are they crazy? This is not the place to keep spent fuel. The places I visited in the United States and in France, they all have the below ground spent fuel pools. They're underground, so they're down below. They're not up at the top of a building. So that blew my mind when I heard that this explosion had affected the.
A lot of us are having our minds blown right now as we continue to be riveted and scared, concerned, if anyone isn't or not paying attention. And I thank you for your comments, and we will check back with you when we have a full picture of the fallout, literally and figuratively, from unfortunate tragedy. Quickly, yes.
Excuse me for interrupting, but I wanted to add one more thing about potassium iodide. Scientists I talked to, radiation biologists and so on, said that if you are not looking at an exposure, and on the West Coast we're not, you should not, it's not good for you to take potassium iodide.
Just, there's side effects.
It's not like taking arnica or something.
Not like taking my iodine tablet. It's a little different.
I would eat a lot of fish, and then you get the iodine, and your thyroid is happy it's getting enough iodine, and it won't
but not fish with a lot of mercury in it. Oh, my goodness, what are we going to do? We're polluting our planet, and we need nature to subsist and to thrive, and we have a lot of challenges, and thank you for your voice in trying to interpret what's happening for us in Japan right now. Gwyneth Cravens, the book is The Power to Save the World, The Benefits of Nuclear Energy, The Truth About Nuclear Energy.
Truth.
Thanks so much for joining us.
Thank you so much, Betsy.
The truth is what we need right now. We'll be back right after these messages with another intriguing author, very different focus, Osprey Oriel Lake. She's written a book called Uprisings for the Earth, Reconnecting Culture with Nature. You're listening to The Green Front. I'm Betsy Rosenberg. Be right back.
This is PRN, Progressive.